I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, I'm Clive Anderson. Welcome to My Seven Wonders. In ancient times, great pyramids, monuments, and other superstructures were identified and celebrated as wonders of the world. And like seas, days of the week, and deadly sins, there were always seven of them. More recent Magnificent Sevens have included other man-made marvels such as Machu Picchu and the Taj Mahal, or wonders of nature such as the Grand Canyon, the Great Barrier Reef. But what are the seven wonders you would put on your personal list? That's the question I ask my guests in this podcast. And the guest I'm asking today is the lugubrious, award-winning comedian, musician, documentary maker and writer, originally from Virginia, USA, Rich Hall. Rich has found award-winning success in the UK, as well as in America and around the world, appearing as either himself or as the even more gravel-voiced reprobate Otis Lee Crenshaw, folk singer, raconteur and good old, maybe bad old boy. Though, come to think of it, are you really Otis Lee Crenshaw? You just sometimes pretend to be Rich Hall for comic effect.
No, I am. I'm definitely Rich Hall.
Okay.
Otis was always a sort of an amalgam of all the relatives that I don't want to go see at Christmas. So there's a whole section of my family that's really pretty rural, pretty backwoods.
He's drawn trailery. From life. He's not a fantasy figure.
It was very easy for me to inhabit that character. Very easy.
And the other fundamental question I would like to ask you is, we know you as a comedian, but you do quite a lot of music making, and there's quite a lot of musical wonders in this list of seven. So there's a possibility you might have gone down a musical route first and then just been known as a musician or a singer who cracked a few jokes, or is it more that suiting you that you're a comedian who can also, you know, throw in a decent performance?
I strived to be a comedian first and foremost, and didn't really feel like I could even attempt. I even wanted to attempt musical comedy till I got to Britain and saw that there were people who did it really well here. In America, that really wasn't the case. It was just, you'd see somebody with a guitar on stage in America and just go, oh boy, here comes a send up of American Pie. It was all just, you know, yeah, pastiches of music that people had heard. And it was, you know, there were a few exceptions. There always have been. But it was kind of a hacky thing to do in America. Then when I got over here and I saw people like Bill Bailey or Tim Minchin in Australia, and I saw that that it could be done, you know, and I just always wanted to make sure that I wrote original music, and that happened to be funny, but I treat it as real songs, you know?
Yeah, no, I know what you mean. There are plenty of those sort of musicians who take a famous song and change a couple of words. And even if it's funny, you think, there's no real career in this, because you're going to find it very difficult to be able to publish this music, perform this music without having to get permission. You've got to write your own stuff or do your own stuff.
Yeah. And also, as I get older as a comedian and I come out on stage and rant and all that stuff, it just starts to look more pathetic. It's great when you're young and you still feel like your jokes can change the world. But then you reach a point where you realize you're just grandpa throwing slippers at the TV, you know? And so the second half of the show that I'm currently doing is very musical, and it just breaks it up. And I think it's more fun for me. And I think it's probably the better part of the show.
Well, I think I know a bit about you, but I've been able to revise and learn new stuff in your autobiography or your memoirs, Rich Hall, Nailing It, Tales from the Comedy Frontier. And I'm never how certain you can be to believe comedians' memoirs, because it might just be stories that are seem funny at the time. But you tell us anyway that you saw a sort of travelling evangelist, a preacher, going around colleges and things, and you thought you could do a comedy version of that. That was your kind of beginning to doing performing. Is that right? Is that true?
That is true. It was kind of a big inside joke. I mean, it only worked at colleges, and the real impact was that this guy Jed Smock he travels all around. He's still around, and he would just rile, and he would go to these colleges and rile the audience up just purposely, and then sort of go into his evangelical mode, and he could just quote anything from the Bible, and he was the best. He's the best person I've ever seen at handling hecklers, and he was the first person I ever saw. You just could not beat him. No matter what you yelled out, he was ready for it. And I just thought it'd be hilarious.
And he had a quote from a verse from the Bible or something.
Oh, God, he was armed with them. Yeah, yeah. And I just thought, well, how great would it be to get a crowd together, and once for about the first 5 or 6 minutes, they think, oh, another campus preacher. And then you just pull the rug out from under them, and they realize, oh, this is like a send-up. It's a, you know, it's a parody of a parody. And that was my start. And then I had about 15 minutes of that worked. And then I just thought of other funny things to start doing. So that's how I got my fearlessness. Because when you have to build a show from scratch, audience and all, you know, you can pretty much handle anything after that.
And just one more thing before we get on to the wonders. Another bit of fearlessness that you record in your book is that when you were performing stand-up comedy in clubs and things, but there you were thinking you might get a big break if you could get onto the David Letterman show or start working with David Letterman, who's just getting going. And so instead of doing just an ordinary set, coming on and doing some jokes, you took the place by storm it was kind of a pizza delivery guy you started doing.
Yeah. Yeah, it was. I was only supposed to do 6 minutes. There were tons of comedians on that show. I remember there was Larry David and Larry Miller and Jerry Seinfeld, and they were all just coming out and doing their 6 minutes, and they were all great. I mean, Seinfeld was the king even when I started out. He was already he was who everyone looked up to. And I just thought, I'm just going to be another guy coming out doing jokes. And I just thought, I'll just go for it. And so I sort of broke the fourth wall and went right out in the audience and tried to get someone to own up to ordering a pizza. But I did it as a Vietnam vet, as an unhinged Vietnam vet. So he had this kind of backstory to him. And the next thing I know, I got hired to work on a talk show. It was literally that, you know, that sort of venerable big break that people talk about. You know, that's what happened for me. One day I was just a club comedian. The next day I was going into Rockefeller Center, which is an amazing place to start a career, to walk into that building and go, whoa, I work here now.
Let's get going, though. We've got to do these wonders, otherwise, well, it'd be ridiculous if we didn't. So what is your first wonder?
All right, my first wonder is because I only revisited this the other day, and it's more wondrous. It's more of a wondrous than an actual wonder, but it's an album called Trout Mask Replica by Captain Beefheart and the Magic Band. Now, have you ever heard it? Have you ever tried to listen to it?
I have. I've
because you look like somebody who would.
Well, I'm of an age to have been aware. When you saw this on your list, I tracked it down and I started listening to it, as I often do when I'm sort of working. I have things in the background, music in the background. This is not kind of music you can have in the background, really, and concentrate on other things. I'm not sure. I think you're going to have to go some to convince me that this is a wonder of the world. I know people respect it, but do you play it a lot? You know, if you have
No, I play it. I think. So I listened to it yesterday.
Yeah.
And that's probably about the ninth time I've listened to it. And I've heard from numerous sources that it takes about 6 listenings for it to start to make sense. And first of all, let me just describe it.
Yes,
it's
please.
It is just. Assonance. Is that a word? It's assonance, dissonance and assonance. And you can't play it in a room with other people. It will clear the room. But there is, it's basically, think Tom Waits without any actual songwriting skills. And Captain Beefheart put this album, the story, to me, what's wondrous isn't the album itself, it's that it got made at all. And Don Van Vliet is Captain Beefheart, and he was a sculptor. He was a sculptor. He was even as a child, he would live in his bedroom and have his parents send him food under the door while he sculpted. And claims that he never went to school, although he did. And he, in high school, he met Frank Zappa. They were both from Lancaster, California, and they became sort of friends. And Frank Zappa kind of mentored him through his musical career. But he wasn't really a musician. He was a sculptor, and I think he wanted to sculpt songs without being able to actually play notes or chords. So he would gather musicians together, and he'd plink out notes on the piano, or he would whistle what he wanted to hear, and then someone would notate it, and then they'd go back and they'd put all this together. So you listen to this thing, and there's four or five different tonal qualities going on, and it's just when you first time you hear it, because of your trained ear, you just go, "What in the hell is this?" And yet, you read about all these people from Johnny Rotten to Tom Waits himself to even the Beatles, who listened to it and just went, "Whoa, this is amazing!" And I think it is amazing in the way sometimes if you see like I don't know, the Watchtower in Los Angeles or some contraption that somebody's put together in their backyard, and you just go, "This is nuts!" But this is the musical equivalent of that, and that's why I find it wondrous, because I can't fathom it. I can't fathom it. Sometimes little snippets of it catch in your head, because there's a lot of wordplay, but the wordplay doesn't add up to anything other than wordplay.
Yeah. And well, it's a double album, so there's a lot of tracks on it. There's Hair Pie, Bake One, Bill's yeah. Bill's Corpse, China Pig, My Human Gets Me Blues. The titles are wondrous in their way. But as I say, you wouldn't, if you went up to a DJ at a, I don't know, any sort of gig or a party or anything, so play a bit of Captain Beefheart. It wasn't his only album, but they got together as a small group of musicians. They were virtually starving at the time of making it, weren't they? They had no income.
Yeah, they were living on soybeans. They were trapped in a house. Beefheart, he had that same work ethic as Frank Zappa. I mean, you look at both those guys and you think they must have done a lot of drugs, but they did no drugs. But he was a taskmaster. And so was Beefheart, and he would he'd make these guys work for 14, 16 hours. They rehearsed the entire album for like 7 months, and then went in and recorded it in 6 hours. And then Beefheart came in the next day and overdubbed his vocals. And of course it was done in 6 hours, because you would listen to it and just go, I could get six kids from around the neighborhood, put instruments in their hands and record it and make this album. But sometimes, every once in a while, when I listen to it, it does kind of break through in a weird kind of way. And I realize you can't compare it to anything you've heard before.
I was going to say, can you think of a way to describe it? It's not punk. It's before punk. 1969. I mean, 1969 is sometimes regarded as quite a big year for music. So if you were looking for a wonderful record from that year, you might have gone with Abbey Road from the Beatles. I think the Stones had an album out. I've forgotten which it is, but it was a big year for music. But do you think of all the records in your record collection, this is the wonder of the world for your first wonder?
No. It is a wonder of the world, but it's not my the most wondrous album. It's one of the worst albums I've ever heard. That's why I consider it a wonder, because I can't fathom it any more than I can fathom game theory or chess. I know there's something there, but I can't access it. And that's what leaves me with a sense of perplexion and awe.
So you might listen to it while also reading James Joyce or something, just to sort of get as many of your synapses going in your brain to try and make sense of it all.
I think your brain would explode if you tried to do that. either of those, you know, either James Joyce or Captain Beefheart. I suppose that Captain Beefheart might very well be the Finnegan's Wake of music, you know.
All right. Well, I'll take that guide to this. You say you need to listen to it six times, I think you said, before you kind of get it. I think I'm maybe three or four times away from fully understanding it then. So I'll have to go away and get up to speed on that. Anyway, it's your first wonder, Trout Mask Replica by Captain Beefheart. And there's a picture of him with a fish mask on. I think it's him. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure it's a trout though, but never mind. It's a fishy thing. So okay, excellent. That's your first wonder. But the second wonder is we're still in the world of music, perhaps more conventionally in the world of music with your second wonder.
Okay, now this truly is the holy grail of modern musical instruments, which is the Martin D28. Acoustic guitar,
right?
Preferably, specifically the what they call a bone or a herringbone, yeah. Because it's got a herringbone trim around the side of it, and anywhere between 1933 and 1944, those guitars are astounding to hold in your hand, to play, to listen to. You know, I guess it's the Stradivarius of acoustic guitars.
Yeah.
And I'm proud to say I own one. I play it on stage. I don't hang it up on a wall. I use it on tour. And I'm not a very good guitarist. I try my best. I can handle my own. But when you play that, it just makes everything easier and sound better. And yeah. It's an astounding work of craftsmanship that they hold up. They've held up this long, you know, almost 80 years now.
Well, you mentioned Stradivarius in passing there. People try and work out what it is about Stradivarius violins and a few other makers and cellos and things, the type of wood that they had access to and lacquer. They didn't know where it came from. But since this is only pre-war, is it possible to know and to work out what it is about those particular guitars? Why can't, you know, would... Could you not make one exactly the same nowadays? Is that not possible?
They did. Yeah, Martin does make a D28 now. That's a 1937 replica. I think it's called the 1937 D28. But it's not. You can't get that wood anymore because it's Brazilian rosewood, which is now illegal to own. And then the sides, the tone woods that they used back then. They don't use now, and the way that they were made and braced on the inside those guys and women, I suppose, they're not around anymore, and then consequently they went off to war, and so
I see,
that's why a pre-war Martin D28 is ideal, because they just had better craftsmanship.
Well, I know a lot of guitarists get quite obsessed, and their fans get quite obsessed with not just acoustic guitars, but electric guitars as well. And, you know, this is the one that was used. Does the ordinary member of the audience, do they, and by which I mean do we, can we tell the difference, really, between these various instruments? Do you have to be really expert to notice the sound?
No, I don't think... I don't think anybody could actually listen to an acoustic guitar and tell whether it's a Gibson or a Martin or any other brand. But the people who play them certainly know. And if you played one for a while, you would be able to hear. You would be able to tell that, you know, almost all bluegrass players play either D18s or D28s, and so it's made kind of for bluegrass picking, but also strumming. Lots of country session musicians will swear by a D28.
So that's your kind of music, isn't it?
Yeah.
Do you like, I'd call it, I don't know, folk music, Americana, bluegrass, whatever. There's generally a sort of there's often a story in it. There's a telling of a story, a sad story quite often, but that fits well with what you do in comedy, which is also quite often telling stories and they can be sad as well, because that therein lies some humour. But was that just everybody played that kind of music around you when you were growing up? So you were almost bound to get some skills on. Play guitar, keyboards, anything else?
Yeah, I started out playing keyboards, but I got tired of dragging that thing around. So then I switched to guitar after I kind of put Otis to bed, and I've only become astute at playing the guitar in the last 10 or 12 years. So I was way behind. You know, I didn't grow up playing music at all. I grew up listening to a lot of music, and I did play piano, but I didn't take it seriously. But of course, when you grow up in the South, that's, you know, blues, country, folk, Southern rock and roll, the Allman Brothers, all that kind of stuff. That's what's on the radio. That's what you hear in clubs and bars. And it's pretty good to come from a region that has its own music. You know, there aren't a lot of places like that. I suppose you could say that of Ireland, to a certain degree, Scotland. I think there's not that sense of, you know, there's Chicago blues, there's New Orleans blues, there's country music, there's Western music. So that's one of the great things about America, is that it has a very strong regional influences when it comes to music.
And right at home, did you have a father or an uncle or an aunt or somebody who showed you how to play the guitar, or was that just Mm-mm. just with friends?
My next door neighbor in Montana taught me how to play guitar. He was a rancher and a choir leader in his church, and he brought me over his guitar one day and said, just sit down and start and learn this and this and this. And that was kind of my start. That was only back in the late 80s. So
It wasn't when you were a little kid.
Nobody in my family was that musical. My dad was he had some pretty eclectic tastes. I distinctly remember him coming home one day, and he was like a teenager playing this song over and over and over again. And the song is A Different Drum by Linda Ronstadt and the Stone Ponies. And this was about, this had to be like 69, maybe 69, 68, 69. And he just freaked out. And it wasn't the kind of music that he listened to. He liked Roger Miller and Frank Sinatra and Duke Ellington and Johnny Cash. But this was like completely accessible. Like, it's a great, great song. And that I was just kind of surprised that's got stuck in his head. And he played it over and over for days and days and days.
Yeah. Don't worry, I can hear a dog every now in the background. We'll bear with that, I think. What sort of dog is
Sarge.
That?
That's a Sarge. He's a Boston Terrier.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah. Very good. We've covered two musical wonders for a moment. Your third wonder, you've just mentioned Montana, so what is your third wonder?
Well, it's the Yellowstone River, Clive.
Yeah.
It's the Yellowstone. And it is a natural wonder. It's just an astounding river.
I think a lot of people will have heard of Yellowstone National Park and have a rough idea of what the scenery looks like, but it's the river itself that you focus on. Is it because it's got a lot of fish, or because it looks beautiful, because it, you know, meanders in a lovely racing white water river? Describe the Yellowstone River.
Both of those things you just said are true. Yes, yeah. There are lots of fish in it. It does meander. It meanders through various valleys. It comes out of the Yellowstone Park, and it flows north and then meets up with the Missouri. And so it's undammed. It's an completely undammed, protected river. Yeah. But it's very amenable to any sort of outdoor activity. So I kayak a lot. I fish. There's a million different things that happen when you go down to the river, and without getting all kind of, you know, metaphorical or anything else, it's just to stand on that river and just watch it go by is just kind of puts everything into perspective.
You mentioned in your book going there with your wife Karen, who's from England, and showing her the river. And I think she, the way of,
I proposed to her on the river. I proposed to her on that river. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
And she obviously said yes.
She thought I was an idiot.
That's a happy memory. I rather more trivially was noticing that she managed to catch a fish or two when you showed her the river, you know, when you're supposed to wait, you know, days, weeks, years before you start doing that. But she had success straight away.
Yep. Beginner's luck. Yeah. But I don't know if you've ever been to Yellowstone Park, which happens to be my favorite park, but it's an astounding, astounding place to be. So I live about 200 yards away from the river. And sadly this summer, about 3 weeks ago, it flooded really badly, like washed away some houses on the river. And you might've seen pictures of that on the news. And so it's pretty much, there won't be any fishing on it this summer. There probably won't be much boating or canoeing or kayaking or anything else because there's so much debris in the river. So it kind of makes you just realize that something you take for granted, you know, and that you think you're fortunate to live near. And then suddenly it just turns and you go, whoa, wow, this is nature at its full rage. And of course, you know, next year it'll probably be back to normal again and just flowing along, but it can be pretty devastating.
So if I got this right, you live a good deal of the time in England, but you you mentioned your book buying a ranch, a farm, a house, or whatever, as a surprise for your wife.
Yeah, not really. As a surprise for me.
Yeah.
I had to talk her into it.
Yes.
I did a very stupid thing. It's actually a story in the book. Yeah, as anybody can tell you, to buy a house, any kind of property, without telling your wife is, yeah, you got your work cut out for you. Yeah, it all worked out.
Yeah, well, but Yellowstone Park, you were asking about. I haven't been there. I do have an ambition to go to those American national parks. They sound fantastic, and Yellowstone Park I'm particularly interested in because they've reintroduced wolves there. Do you, which has a profound effect on the landscape. Do you have anything to do with the wolves, or do you hide away from them, or are you an enthusiast for them?
I'm all for the wolves, but most ranchers and farmers would differ. They appreciate the wolves, but the wolves are supposed to stay in the park. But of course, they're wolves, so they don't.
Yeah.
So then, when they come out of the park, which is not fenced in, it's just you know, 1 minute you're not in the park, and then you step over this invisible boundary, and you're in the park. The wolves don't know that, so sometimes they venture out, and then that's not good for them. But yeah, they're beautiful animals.
Yes,
I've run into them now and then in the park, along with buffalo, and I find it hilarious that at least I think it's already happened three times this year. It's some idiots go up to buffalo, stand right in front of them and try to take a picture, and the next thing you know, all step about 20 feet in the air, and then they make the news, and people in Montana just kind of go, well, what did you think was going to happen? It's a buffalo.
Yeah.
It's a 2-ton animal with horns, and he wants to be left alone. But people think, oh, they're so docile. And they just go right up to him. One woman picked up a calf and put it in the back of her car because she thought it was orphaned. And then, and then sadly, they had to put the thing down because it had been in contact with humans. So it's like, don't, if you go to Yellowstone Park, enjoy the river, but don't touch the critters. Don't touch them.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Well, next topic. Let's go into that. Next wonder.
Well, of course, you know, you would probably expect most of your guests to you know, breach the literary world at some point in one of their wonders. I'm sure a lot of your guests have mentioned some great book that they read, and so I'm going to go with it. I'm going to go with that. But when I think about the book that has influenced me the most, you know, I'd love to say Finnegan's Wake or you know, Staggering Work of Genius or whatever that is, which I never finished, or Thomas Pynchon, but it's a very simple book called Catcher in the Rye. And Catcher in the Rye, unlike Trout Mask Replica, I do go back and reread it all the time because it never gets. There's something new in it every time I read it as I get older. And it's an amazing book because for the fact that... Have you read Catcher in the Rye?
I certainly have. I don't know why you're being slightly apologetic about selecting this as a wonder, because I would say in this country, and I'm sure in America too, it's a book that almost everybody, I think, would have been introduced to at school. And... even though the sort of some of the slang terms change over the years, you can immediately recognise the true voice of the teenager, in sort of agony, really, in the Holden Caulfield and Rater and that. He is going through a really hard time, but it's recognisable to, I would think, almost everybody who's ever grown up.
Yeah, but it was written in like the 40s, and that's what. And when I first read it, probably in the early 70s, I suppose, it still just rang. It was so relevant to modern day life as it was at the time it was written. And it still is when you go back and read it now. And when you read Catcher in the Rye as a teenager, it's very hard. It's one of those books that you come away and you can't get that voice out of your head, that tone, which is very sarcastic, very, anti-education. I mean, it's about a kid who basically drops out of school and goes to New York City for the weekend. Nothing really happens. There's no huge plot twist or turns. It's just about a guy who just says the word phony shows up so much. And it's there's a moment where basically the title refers. He's misread the title, I think. I forget where Catcher, if a body sees a body coming through the rye, I forget what that's from. But he sees...
It's a Robert Burns poem, and it's...
Right,
It's a body coming through the rye. He misremembers it as catching. So he's... you go on to explain.
Well, he's just... Between his teachers, his parents, and the various New York Manhattanites that he comes across, he just ultimately... sees kind of some kind of solace and imagining being in a field and just of rye, and all these kids are just running through it, and his job is to keep them from going off a cliff. And it's such an amazing childlike image of, you know, of that is what, that is all he really, that would be his idea of happiness, you know, just to be looking after kids. And it's very sympathetic toward, you know, young kids and his younger sister, Phoebe, I think it's Phoebe. And but when you come away after reading that book, and you can read it in 2 days, you know, when you come away, I think it probably made me a comedian. It certainly gave me that sense of viciousness and sarcasm that you have to have as a comedian, and not take and to look at everything and question it. And that's what and that's what Catcher in the Rye does. And I think it, you know, I didn't close the book and say, oh, I'm going to be a comedian. But I think it sent me in that direction. And it, then I showed it to my daughter, read it, I don't know, about 3 years ago when she was 14. And she kind of, I think there's a bit of Salinger in her now, you know.
Yeah.
So it has a very profound effect on some people. Some people have read and go, yeah, I don't get it. Nothing happened. But yes. Everything happened.
But he's cracking up, and he's just full of lots of little incidents. Isn't he? He's failing most of his subjects, but he's very good at English. So one of his, you know, roommates or whatever it is says, "Oh, can you just knock off a bit of work for me, but put a few punctuation marks a bit wrong, because otherwise they'll know it's you." And
I think that was Edgar Marcellus. I think that was that character's name.
All right.
But it's because J.D. Salinger was such a renowned recluse, you know, and never really talked about the book. But I think I've read a lot of dissertations about it, and it's very likely that what prompted him to write the book was post-traumatic stress disorder from World War II. Yes. And he had a pretty rough time, Salinger, during the war. And was stationed in England, and had to, when there was an incident on the south coast of England. You probably know this. I forget where it was, but it was a training program with American soldiers. It went wrong, and the American soldiers got killed, maybe a dozen or so.
Was that a D-Day landing thing? They had an exercise.
Yeah, they were practicing the D-Day landing, and something went wrong, and Salinger had to go down and I think sort of help clean up the mess, and that profounded, you know, that affected him profoundly, and I think that when he came back and wrote this book, that was at the root of it, which of course you'd never get in the book, but it
obviously opened up his ability to just say what's in his mind at that point, and capturing what's in a lot of people's minds. Yeah, he was a recluse. He was also very protective of his work. He didn't want it filmed or done in any other way. After an initial discussion, he protected that very firmly. I presented a program on the television which was about people's favourite books, and there were people advocating their books, and they did, I think Ruby Wax did this particular one, saying how she loved it as well, and they put in just a sort of somebody speaking something from the book, dressed roughly as, you know, Holden Caulfield would look like, and there was a big, you know, argument about that. That was, you know, imagining it and representing it in a theatrical way, and they had a huge sort of bust off over that. It wasn't strictly my responsibility. I was just introducing things, but I think it was all settled relatively amicably in the end. But even just sort of somebody saying, "I think this is a very good book and should be the best book, you know, our favourite book," he found uncomfortable to see somebody putting on a costume and speaking his words. but there it is. Okay, well, let's go on to, I would suggest, something a bit more obscure as a wonder of the world for a good many of us, but that's not to undervalue it. Your next wonder, please.
PTO.
Right.
And here's
which normally
where,
means...
I know you. And what does it normally mean?
PTO means please turn over. It means it's at the bottom of a page to make sure you there's a bit more written on the other side, or keep going to the end of the chapter. Keep turning over to the end of the document. You've got to sign it before you send in your license or whatever it is. But what does it mean in your...
Well, Clive, now your farmers and your ranchers who listen to your podcast will know right away that PTO stands for power takeoff.
Right.
And without it, there's no food. There's no fence posts. There's no grain. The power takeoff is the part of the tractor that operates the machinery.
Okay.
It's the shaft at the back of the tractor that turns at various RPMs, and consequently runs the mowers, runs post hole diggers, runs any kind of almost any kind of appendage to a tractor, and without it, everybody's digging holes. The world would be digging holes with a shovel and picking and cutting grass with a scythe. And it's what keeps the agricultural world going. Yeah. And all somebody did was think, let's hook this drive shaft up to an engine and then spin it really fast. And then you can plug anything into it.
Yeah.
I just find
when did do that? How long have we had a PTO tractors?
Oh God, Clive, I don't know. I didn't do any research on this. Probably I'd say the late 1800s, somebody came up with some kind of version of it.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I just wanted to establish this is a long established, well established bit of mechanical kit that's been around. I think, so many things were invented at the end of the 19th century, right at the beginning of the 20th, to do with the internal combustion engine, diesel engines, petrol engines, gears. I'm sure somebody's saying from about 1910 onwards, all they've been doing is trying to think of intermittent wash wipe or a way of rolling and unrolling their windows, none of which is vital. And this is obviously another thing, and I must confess to being blissfully ignorant that somebody had to come up with this special invention, and it's still going strong. It's still the thing you need on your tractor, as you say, to dig your fence.
To be honest, it really hasn't changed. If you had a tractor from 1928, if you had a John Deere or a Farmall tractor from 1928, the attachment is going to be pretty much the same. It's a shaft, and you got to drag whatever machinery you have up to it, reach up under there, try not to get your fingers cut off. It's incredible. Yeah. It's very bulky and burdensome, but once you learn how to do it, I remember first time I learned how to hook something up to a PTO, I just felt like the agricultural world had opened up to me.
Yes.
And if I ever saw someone broken down on the side of the road, at least I'd know how to help them. That's why I find it a wondrous thing.
Right. So this locks you into your country music, your country living, your place in Montana. I'm sure you've got an old tractor up there so you can drag your fish home from the river or whatever it is that you need to cope with.
No, there's no fish dragging device for tractors as far as I know.
Oh, no.
No, you have to put the fish back, you know.
Yes.
Yeah, you're not allowed to drag fish. Not allowed to drag fish.
No, I wasn't implying you were doing anything wrong. I was just imagining uses for this bit of kit for you.
Yeah. But I did go one day. I had to change it three times one day. I had to change it from a mower to a post hole digger to a trailer hitch. Mm. So there you go. That's my claim to. That's my greatest day. It's my greatest agricultural day ever.
Your manly life in the outback. No, that's Australia, isn't it? The prairie.
Look, you know, some people like to shoot off an AR-15 or something. They go, "Ooh, yeah, I did that." But when you've hooked up a PTO, that is a skill that stays with you the rest of your life. And sooner or later, somebody's going to need me to do it. They're going to need me. I'm going to get a phone call, even in London, and some guy up the street, you know, trying to cut down a tree. He's going to go, "Hey, can you help me with this?" Sometimes it takes two people to do it.
Yeah. It's great when you can do something, when you're on top of something. Just the other night there, I was on the train, a tube train, and there were a couple, they had got on the wrong train, and they couldn't work out to do. And I knew what to do. I could tell them what they had to do. And I thought, I'm on top of this. I have learnt something in life. I know how the London Underground system works. And
Those are the things that... Those are the things that become important in your life, you know.
Okay, look, we've dealt with PTO. I've learned what PTO stands for. I'm going to be looking out for it the next time I'm near a tractor, which I am from time to time, without ever realising I was looking at something important. So, your sixth wonder. We've got to rattle on. We're going to run out of time. Your sixth wonder.
All right, we're back to music, Clive. We're back to music. This is one of those... moments equivalent to standing on the Yellowstone, where I've stood inside the Ryman Auditorium in Nashville, which is the cathedral of country music, and felt like, wow, this is where it's so much has happened in that building.
So this is Grand Ole Opry. Is that the term to use?
It's the original home of the Grand Ole Opry. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. See, there's two Grand Ole Opry's now. There's the one, the original one in Ryman, where they do some shows, and then there's Opryland, which is a horrible, horrible theme park on the outside of Nashville, which is what most people go to now when they think they've gone to the Grand Ole Opry. But the real Grand Ole Opry is still at Ryman Auditorium. Not every weekend, but a lot of weekends in the summer. And it's also used for all kinds of other Americana and country music events. And the most astounding show I've ever seen was at the Ryman Auditorium. And if I even try to describe it to you, you'll go, what? But it was during what they called Chet Atkins days, which is a tribute to the guitarist Chet Atkins. And so I didn't know what I was going to. Someone gave me a ticket. And I went in, and on stage is Mark Knopfler from Dire Straits. And I'm thinking, am I at the right show? What's Mark Knopfler got to do with the Grand Ole Opry?
Well, and eventually he's a great guitarist, isn't he?
So yeah, and of course, his style, his mentor was Chet Atkins. So but that's not the guy you think you'd see hosting a show. He was the host. He wasn't just a guest. He was the host. He was the MC of the show. And he says, so he plays a couple of songs. He played a couple of Chet Atkins songs. And then he says, okay, I'm going to bring out our first guest. And he brings out John Prine.
All right.
Who recently passed away, great songwriter. So now I'm like, whoa, okay. Then he brings out the guy from he's with the Eagles now, Vince Gill. So they're all playing Chet Atkins songs. Mark Knopfler is astounding. The audience is really into it. The show goes on. I'm really settling into it. He says, okay, I'm going to bring, now please welcome Kris Kristofferson. So Kris Kristofferson comes out and starts singing Sunday Morning Coming Down. And halfway through that song, Johnny Cash walks out and says, looks at the crowd. He'd been in the hospital with something. He walks up to the mic and he says, I'm not dead yet. And he and Kris do a duet of Sunday Morning Coming Down. And it's just one thing, one astounding musician after another. And then, we're getting toward like an hour and a half in. And then Mark Knopfler just says, all right, I guess I'd get run out of town if I didn't play some of these songs. And then he brings out Dire Straits. And it turns into a Dire Straits concert at the Grand Ole Opry. And you can tell, and some people in the crowd are looking around going, what in the hell? What? This is... But there were a lot of people like me were going, wow, okay.
These aren't even American. What are they doing here?
Yeah. And it just blew me away. It was just... I've also just walked in there, and I think we filmed there before, making documentaries when you're in there all by yourself. And the acoustics are just astounding. You walk up on the stage and just say anything, and it just comes back at you. It was built.
All right.
It's a church of music. And if you ever get a chance to stand in it, because just all the people who have stood on that stage before you.
And you've stood on that stage. Have you done a performance there, a concert there, a comedy tour even there with plus music? Would that ever happen?
I've stood on the stage, not played in front of an audience. No. Someday I will. Yeah.
Well, I'm sure you will. I was assuming you. You had already, but I assume that's why it was a wonder to you. But you're basically approaching it as a member of the audience, as a lover of that, that sort of music. Yeah,
yeah. Just a wooden rose. You go over, you get a beer, you come back, you sit down, and anything that comes out, and it could be the hackiest country act, but somehow, in that particular environment, you just go, oh, okay, you can tell anybody who stands on that stage and plays is thrilled beyond belief to be there,
And then they're top of their game as a result.
Yeah. I can't think of maybe Carnegie Hall for classical music or something, but there aren't many places where you can truly say this is the cathedral of this particular type of music. Ryman Auditorium is.
Yeah. What about your own performing career? Where would you say is the place you've performed and thought, right, this, I can't do better than this. This is just fantastic performing here.
I'd like to say the Sydney Opera House, but In fact, I think this is one of the this is one of the chapters in my book. It was awful. It was absolutely awful. They try read the book. There's a whole chapter in the book about me doing an Otis show at Sydney Opera House and it going horribly, horribly wrong.
Like I wasn't really trying to push you into telling a story about going horribly wrong. I was.
That would have. I mean, you know, I can say I played it. My poster was out front, but it did not. It was not conducive to comedy. The Sydney Opera House is not conducive to comedy. Not this particular night. It wasn't.
Oh, all right. So, we're straying away from your wonder anyway, which is there in Nashville, the Ryman Auditorium, the original home of the Grand Ole Opry, and they were kind of getting rid of it, and moving on. But I think people who were fans of it said, no, you can't pull it down. You've got to keep it.
Too many. I mean, there would have been so many musicians who came to rescue that place. You know. Mm. It's a large scale equivalent of the Half Moon in Putney, which is under the same constant threat of being demolished.
Yes.
But
right.
Somebody always steps up to help it out.
Okay, the Half Moon in Putney and the Ryman Auditorium in Nashville, I guess they'd be happy to be coupled together, twinned around the world. What about the thing about comedy is that you can be successful when you tell a joke to one audience. Or do a bit, 5 minutes and it goes a storm. You do it in front of another audience on another day. Maybe you're in a worse mood. Maybe it's a different audience. Maybe there's some, and it can, and it crashes and burns, which in a way that playing a song is never going to be that high and then that low, because you're always going to be a competent singer or a guitarist at whatever level you are. Whereas doing a joke, you can go from being the funniest guy in the room and you've got a microphone and everything to, what's he doing? My mate tells jokes better than that. And that happens, I think, to almost everybody, just not too often once you get going.
Yeah. The only thing I can say is that you get better at not bombing as you go along.
Yeah.
You get better at reading an audience, you know. I got to go back to Edinburgh this year for 2 weeks. I haven't been in 6 years. And I know I'm going to do some of those late night shows. And as soon as you walk out, you know what I'm talking about. You walk out, and it's just a sweat pit. And you walk out, and this is not the same crowd that paid to come see you earlier. These are just people out at 2 a.m, and they can just be violent, you know. And I'll do my best, you know, to take the kind of general atmosphere and shape it to what I'm doing, you know. If you can't read the room, you're going to die. You're going to die. But you learn to read rooms, and you learn to. And as you get better and more established, you also don't have to choose those kind of environments. They can still happen. You can walk into a snake pit by accident, but more than likely you go, I'm not doing that.
You got one more wonder to go, and this is an intriguing one and an eye opener to me. It's your last wonder.
Yeah, my last wonder is an address. It's 3970 Spencer Street, Las Vegas, Nevada. 3970 right. Spencer Street.
Yeah,
you can go on to Google that right now, and you'll see it actually comes as a real estate listing.
I've done exactly that. And of course, when I first saw this, all I had was that address. I thought, well, I wonder what happened to you there. Did you meet a girl? Did you win a fortune at some sort of poker game in Las Vegas? Is it the most beautiful building that you've driven past or whatever it is? And but it's none of those things, but it's more important, more bizarre than all of those things. So.
Yeah. 3970 Spencer Street is in a suburban looking neighborhood in Las Vegas. There's a house on it that just looks like, you know, your regular stucco and red tile roof, typical kind of desert house. You go in the front door, there's an elevator on your left. If you go into that elevator and take it down, you come out to the most astounding underground house you can imagine. I don't mean like a nuclear bunker. I mean, this is a complete underground house with interior lighting that you know, the sun comes up in the morning, it goes down around, you know, depending on time of year, stays light later and later. You walk out around the outside of the house. It's a very 50s looking house. It's got, you know, one of those old yellow and black tiled kitchens in it. Everything is kind of retro. It's like a good housekeeping house from the 50s.
Right.
And
it occupies a huge amount of space underground. It's
I think it's
house
about
size.
Yeah, it's like a 4-bedroom house with doors that open up and go out onto a fake turf lawn. It's got a swimming pool. It's got a disco. It's got giant boulders and trees around it. And as you travel around the outside on the wall, the outside supporting wall, you're in a different country. They painted all these scenes from different countries. So basically you can travel around the world. You can walk out one bedroom and you're in New Zealand. You walk out another bedroom and you're in Switzerland. And it's the story behind it is the first time I went there, I was working in Las Vegas, and my friend says, "Hey, let's go meet Muhammad Ali's daughter." It was a friend of mine named Harris, and he knew Muhammad. Muhammad Ali used to come to the Comedy Store in L.A. a lot, and Harris got to know him, and he got to know his daughters. So we go and knock on this door, and I think I'm going to meet Maymay Ali. Her name is Maymay, and she was going to law school at UNLV. And so we knock on the door. Of course, I want to meet Muhammad Ali's daughter. So she opens the door. She is the caretaker. She's become the caretaker for this place. She lives upstairs.
Yeah.
And so we talk for a while, and I'm going, "Oh, that's nice." And she says, "Come on in." And we never even went into the living room of the main house. She just says, "Here we go." And we go into this elevator, and we come down, and it opens up, and you're in this underground, this astounding underground dwelling. And there was an 82-year-old guy living there named Tex. And he says, "Come on, I'll show you around." So we walk around, and then we end up in the main bedroom, and he opens up this closet, and it's all all the dresses, it's all the costumes from Cleopatra that belong to Liz Taylor. It's Liz Taylor's wardrobe in this guy's house underground in Las Vegas named Tex, who is a sports writer who Muhammad befriended a long time. He used to write great articles about him, and he's living there. And I said, "Where did this come from?" And he says, "Well, I was married to the Avon lady, the woman whose husband started the Avon products." And his name was, I think his name was Gerald Henderson. He was fascinated with underground houses. He built it back in the 50s during the, you know.
Yeah.
I guess he was worried about nuclear bombs. So he built this mansion underground. Then he dies. His wife is the cosmetic heiress. She marries Tex. Then she dies. And now Tex is living underground. He's 81 years old, and he's got a caretaker who's one of Muhammad Ali's old boxing sparring partners. He looks after Tex, and like every step of this tour, there's something else. I've since gone back 3 or 4 times, and I think we filmed a scene in a documentary I made about Red Menace, about nuclear, about, you know, the Cold War. And we went back, and now it's a real estate agent came in and let us film there, and all of Elizabeth Taylor's stuff was gone, and Tex had moved on. This was 2 years ago. Tex had passed on, and now the house is up for sale for like $15 million or something.
I think you're overstating it. I've got it in front of me here. It says $5.9 million.
Oh, 5.9. Okay.
So that's well within. If you sold your place in Montana and maybe you got a nice flat in London, you'd probably get $5.9 million together straight away. But how does it work? Can you survive down there? For that's always the weakness of these survival places, because you eventually need food, water, oxygen. And if there is nuclear war above you, all that's going to get contaminated. So have they got big stores of that, so you can live an extra 6 months longer than everybody else before all the stores run out?
Well, the kitchen was full of canned peaches when I was there. There was about 6,000 cans of peaches. It's ventilated. in the house outside, if you look over in the parking lot, you'll see these vents coming up. So my guess is that there, this guy, if he had the money to build this kind of palace, he certainly had the money to provide for, you know, an actual nuclear attack. So there must be some form of air purifying system or something there.
Right.
But the thing is, you can't get anybody. Nobody really wants to live in an underground house. They can't sell it. They can't sell it.
No.
Nor can they really turn it into a museum because it's in the middle of a suburban neighborhood, you know.
Yeah.
So you have to ask around, and if you have a film crew or something, maybe they'll let you come in. They've always let me come in because I ended up being friends with Tex. I knew Tex, and then I knew Maymay, and now I know the real estate agent who's trying to sell it. And it's some owned by some friends for the preservation of the earth or something who now own it. They're trying to unload it. It's for sale.
You've attracted my interest in that. But we've come to the end of your wonders. Thank you very much for joining us joining me for this trip down your seven wonders. A fascinating selection of wonders, if I may say so. I have to choose the wonder of wonders from our list of seven, the one which struck me as particularly wonderful, as you described it on this podcast. And you know, I was pretty convinced I was going to probably choose the Yellowstone River in Montana because I'd love to go there. I admire your admiration of Catcher in the Rye, but I'm afraid 3970 Spencer Street at the last in Las Vegas has won it, simply because you've got a story that starts with your mate saying, oh, let's go meet Muhammad Ali's daughter, and that's before you even get to the house. So,
yeah.
And this extraordinary prospect, and I hope somebody does buy it and do something interesting with it, though I agree with you. I can't see what that interesting thing could possibly be. Anyway, thank you, Rich. It's good to talk to you again. I've bumped into you on QI from time to time years ago, and I noticed you. I think you're the person who wins QI more often than anybody, and because your technique is so clever, because you don't burble on making all the wrong answers, which most of us do when we guess on that. You just wait and say something funny when you feel like it, and leave the rest of people to burble on. A great tactic.
Yeah, sniper. I'm a sniper.
Yes. Yeah.
Winning on that show is not like winning the Grand Slam in tennis, is it?
No, I know. It's not, maybe not the main thing, but it's something. Anyway, thank you very much. If you enjoyed listening to My Seven Wonders, it would be wonderful if you could rate and review us on Apple Podcasts or whichever platform, site or provider you found us on. Thank you for listening. Thank you to Rich Hall.
Thank you.
Goodbye.
My Seven Wonders with Clive Anderson is a Stack production in association with Alaska TV and powered by the Acast Creator Network.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.